This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
One of my favorite sections of Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, is the mind waves section. Let's see if this sounds familiar in the context of this week's teachings. Suzuki Roshi says, many sensations come, many thoughts or images arise, but they are just waves of your own mind. Nothing comes from outside your own mind. Usually we think of our mind as receiving impressions and experiences from outside. That's not a true understanding of our mind. The true understanding is that the mind includes everything. When you think sometimes from outside, it means only that something appears in your mind. All-inclusive mind is the same as nothing external to mind, right? Or what we're calling boundless presence. Suzuki Roshi says, nothing outside yourself can cause any trouble. You yourself make the waves in your mind. If you leave your mind as it is, it will become calm. This mind is called big mind. Does he mean that when the mind is in calm abiding, when we're just aware of being aware, that's big mind? Or is it more this insight that he just mentioned, that there's actually nothing outside the mind, or both? The mind left as it is calm. This is big mind, but really when we clarify that nothing comes from outside the mind, I think even more that's what he means by big mind. If your mind is related to something outside itself, that mind is a small mind, a limited mind. If your mind is not related to anything else, then there's no dualistic understanding in the activity of your mind. I think when I first read these teachings in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, I thought they were pretty good, but I think a lot of the nuances were lost on me. Now it strikes me as he's saying something very radical here. We usually say that, you know, interdependence, dependent arising of everything, isn't that like our basic teaching? Everything's interdependent. Here, Suzuki Roshi is saying, as big mind, it's not related. It's not in relationship to anything. And relationship and dependence, I think, are virtually the same. This big mind is not dependent on anything, and it's not related to anything. It's not in relationship. It's kind of the other side of the story of everything's in relationship and interdependent. Here he's saying, if your mind is related to anything outside itself, That's a small, limited mind. It's okay. I mean, our dualistic consciousness is it actually in relation to everything, in relation to other things. If we're looking at a flower that seems to be outside ourselves, we're in relationship with the flower and dependent on the flower. That's called small mind. This is quite profound what he's saying here. Big mind is not in relationship. Why? Because it's so big that there's nothing outside it to be related to. Everything's included. If your mind is not related to anything else, he says, there's no dualistic understanding in the activity of mind. You understand activity as just waves of your mind. Big mind experiences everything within itself. Do you understand the difference between these two minds? He asks in an inquiry-like way. Difference between these two minds, the mind which includes everything and the mind which is related to something. Do you understand the difference? This is Suzuki Roshi's koan of the day. Real inquiry, question. One mind we're calling big mind, there's nothing outside it to be related to. Everything's included within itself. And then small mind is in relationship to the world and other minds and so on. It's okay, but we're calling it small mind. Do you understand the difference between the mind which includes everything and the mind which is related to something? He says, actually, they're the same thing. But the understanding is different, and your attitude towards life will be different according to which understanding you have. That everything is included within your mind is the essence of mind. And whatever you experience is an expression of big mind. I think this is a nice point about Vipassana here too, that even though we could say, really we're talking about two different perspectives on the same situation. One's called big mind, one's called small mind. He says that they're actually the same thing, but the understanding is different. We could say the perspective is different. And your attitude towards life will be different according to which understanding and perspective you have. And the deeper we clarify the difference in perspective, the deeper the difference in our whole life will be. This is not just some insight on meditation Christian. This is maybe most easy to verify on Christian because we don't have to do anything else at that time. But then it's not like the reality changes when we get off the Christian lines. Ideally, it permeates into our whole ordinary everyday life. And but just a shift of perspective. Could we even go so far as to say that the Buddha's unsurpassed, complete, perfect awakening is nothing more than just a shift of perspective. And it's such a radical shift of perspective that it comes along with all kinds of, you know, powers and abilities and byproducts. But the essence, the heart of the Buddha's awakening, I would say the heart of it is really just a shift of perspective. Of course, reality is not changing. But each person's perspective on it can change. Someone else asked regarding the inquiry methods of Vipassana, how do you know when to start questioning, and also how do you know when to stop questioning? This is a good question. We may have talked a little bit about how to know when to start. It's very intuitive. Some people say, wait till you're really, really settled and present and a lot of calm abiding. Some would say, you need almost no calm abiding. In the Theravada tradition, they sometimes speak of, it's called dry insight. Dry insight means you're doing Vipassana insight work without any foundation or moistening of calm abiding. And I think it's not even really criticized when it's brought up. It's just different types of people have the inclinations to do this in a moist style or dry style. It's an interesting term going way back, maybe to the Buddha, but I know that Buddha Gosha, for instance, this dry insight is you're just starting to question things just in your ordinary consciousness without being in this special state of calm abiding, which for some people, that works, that's fine. So you don't need any calm abiding. Enough so you're not like completely wandering all over the place. And then the maybe moist insight is when it's moistened by this moistening of calm abiding and makes the mind very flexible and ready and buoyant and focused. Moisture can help. So when you, how much moisture you need to start inquiring is up to each person. You can experiment with not much at all. And if we're investigating the nature and qualities of this very awareness and our calm abiding practice is using this very awareness as its object, but first just resting in and as awareness to develop calm abiding, then it's not that big a shift to then just start exploring the awareness that we're already resting in. Like we've entered this room called calm abiding. And now instead of just sitting in the room, we're like starting to walk around the room and check it out. Look at the walls and so on. So it doesn't have to like totally disrupt being in the room, right? To look around the room. And then this question of, well, then we just keep questions, do we keep asking the same question over and over, or when do we stop? It's an interesting one too. Again, it's very intuitive. Each person could do this differently, but it may be that we're asking, for example, does this present awareness seem to arise and cease? Does it seem to change at all? Or is it just the contents of the awareness that is changing constantly? We can, you know, ask this question and then ask it enough so we're really like looking into like, what does this mean that it would not be changing at all? And develop some sense, or by asking the question, the verification can start to develop more and more. I can't see that the actual space in which all the content is happening, I can't really see that it is changing. It seems like it's always the same in every situation, but it takes a little time to verify this, because I feel like the situation's changing, the contents are changing, and I'm usually so focused on the contents, I don't notice anything that's not changing. So we're carefully, gently looking beneath the changing contents, confirming, is there some aspect of this experience that's not changing, like the experiencing of it? And then we feel some sense of like, yeah, I can see where that question is directed to. I can see that something's shifting in my perspective having asked this question. It doesn't have to be some big dramatic thing, but just, oh. Also, these questions, we're not going to like get them, like we're not going to get these answers like packaged in a nice little box with a ribbon on it that, you know, that we can put it on the shelf over here. It's subtle. It's more like a sense. Maybe we have a stronger and stronger sense that there's an unchanging space, timeless presence in which all these changes are happening. Just a little sense of that. We could say that's the verification. It might not be Big Bang. And then at that point, we could keep asking deeper, but let me become really sure here. And, you know, maybe new questions naturally come up as we start to explore. Maybe some doubts come up about this, our own unique doubts. And then we can dig a little deeper and look. And but at the point, maybe we feel like, yeah, no, this is where the question was leading. And there's some confirmation, at least for this moment. And then we stop asking. That would be like a time to stop asking. When we feel like there's enough verification of this point that to keep asking about would be kind of getting distracted from tasting the verification of it. So that would be like a stopping point. And then sometimes it's said, I kind of like this language, at this point, just rest in the verification, the non-conceptual verification, the sense, the non-conceptual sense of an unchanging spaciousness. So that we fully taste it, resting in it. If we keep asking, we're maybe like not fully savoring the flavor of the verification. And if we jump to another question right away, we also maybe aren't savoring it. So we can savor it. That may be enough. We just have this one question and we're savoring the verification the rest of the period, or maybe more commonly, really, until we get distracted by some other random thought about something else. Still, something happened there and maybe was encouraging enough to we try it again. The another way is we stop questioning when we get totally distracted by some other random question, like what's for lunch? And then we didn't mean to stop it. It just got like overtaken by another question. Then we can, oh, wait, was it? Oh, yeah. Is there any coming and going in the actual presence of awareness itself? So we have a little verification again, rest in that, get distracted again, ask again, or go on to another question. Okay, that was the temporal quality. I have kind of some sense for this now. I'm going to explore the spatial quality. Does it have any edges or location? The presence of awareness. So it's all very personalized. You could ask, especially if you get used to asking the same questions again and again, which I think is very helpful. Make these familiar pathways of essential inquiries. Then it becomes maybe easier to like, I know that kind of how that pathway to the verification goes. I just ask it and immediately, if we're really present, maybe immediately say, oh yeah, let's confirm that one. Next one, and then we get to like, you know, as they go deeper, they may be a more subtle, so they're taking a little more time. So there's no set way. Another image from the Indian tradition of you could say, how to know when to stop, or the kind of purpose of that. How the conceptual inquiry leads to the non-conceptual verification is the image of rubbing two sticks together to make a fire. And so one stick is like the question, the inquiry question. And does awareness have any edges? Does this presence have any bounds? That's one stick. And the other stick is the object that we're questioning, like the edges of awareness. And so the question is coming up in meeting the object of inquiry. They're getting very intimate, rubbing the two sticks together. The question is applying to this experiential issue of edges of awareness, rubbing them together, interacting, the questioning process. And then at some point, the fire starts. And the fire of non-conceptual, luminous, blazing wisdom, if you want to talk about it in kind of fancy way. You know, it's fire. It's the fire isn't in either one of the sticks, but the interaction of this process of rubbing the sticks creates this like magic, right? This fire bursts forth. And then this fire is like a new thing. Maybe we could say in our discussion that the fire is like the verification, non-conceptual verification. And then the fire, maybe we want to make sure it's really going. We're still rubbing the sticks, the fire is blazing more. And then at some point, we drop the sticks that started the fire into the fire. And they burn up. And it's a nice image. So that's where we drop the questioning, and we drop the object that we were questioning, and the whole thing becomes a non-dual verification or like confidence in the that is the result of the questioning. And then there's no more questioning. And then you rest in the confidence of how it is. In a non-conceptual way, which is like just being the fire. And then we could even say at some point the fire, the fuel of the fire wears off and the fire dies out. And that would be like the thought of like, okay, so now what's for lunch? And then we can start a new fire with two new sticks. So that's a nice image, traditional image for a kind of experiential image for how conceptual investigation dissolves into non-conceptual realization. Now we've finished the first page of Dogen's Zamai, Ozamai. I think the first page was kind of tough going. There's a lot of juicy stuff in there. And I think the second page is easier. It's more straightforward. So we can enjoy the downhill ride, the rest of Sesshin, just gliding along now, maybe. Now, in this essay, Dogen's going to start quoting this treatise. He says Shakyamuni Buddha, but he's wrong. It's actually not really Shakyamuni Buddha who spoke these words. It's a commentary on the Buddha by Nagarjuna, attributed to Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna's commentary on Maha Pradnya Paramita Sutras. So before we get into Nagarjuna's commentary, before we get into Dogen's commentary on Nagarjuna's commentary on the Buddha's commentary on the Samadhi that's the king of Samadhis, first start with the sutra itself. But note the fact that this is kind of like the traditional style of Zen, is commentary upon commentary upon commentary. It's always got to be new and fresh, and yet we can't just make it up out of the blue. That's maybe what a lineage is. It's based on tradition. It's got to carefully, meticulously maintain the understanding of the tradition of the Buddhas and ancestors that came before, but it's got to also at the same time not just repeat the words, but say it in a fresh way. This is the challenge of continuing a lineage. It's easy to either start neglecting the old teachings and reinterpreting them in some personalized way. It's very easy to do that. Or just kind of repeat the same thing, or might as well just read the sutra instead. So some kind of middle way of walking here. So first of all, there's the great perfect wisdom scriptures, the Buddha, the Prajna Paramita Sutras, of which there are many. This is one of the first Mahayana teachings, probably amongst the first, in around the year zero in the land of Jambudvipa, India. And there's many Prajnaparamita sutras, long and short, from 100,000 lines, maybe the biggest, which they still recite like in the first days of the new year in Japanese Zen temples. There's these boxes and boxes of books, huge cartons of, you know, accordion style, Japanese style, sutra books, like a chapter, a book for each chapter. And then it would take like years to read it all in order, and you only have 3 days. So you pick up a volume, pick up a chapter, and you recite like mantras while you just like fan this accordion sutra open. So all the pages kind of flip by, and the letters on the pages radiate out into the room and throughout the universe. So that's called reading the large Prajnaparamita Sutra in 3 days. And then maybe the next shorter one is the 25,000 line. And that one, we have a translation in English called the Large Sutra on Perfect Wisdom. And that's the one that's gonna be the topic of this next section of Dogen. That's the one where the Samadhi Raja Samadhi appears. But then there's also an 8,000 line Prajnaparamita Sutra. There's the Diamond Sutra, Vajracchedaka Prajnaparamita Sutra, and 100 lines or something. And then there's the Hridaya Pradnaparamita Sutra, as the Eno has been announcing, the Heart Sutra. And then that's almost the shortest, but then the very shortest of them all is Prajnaparamita in one letter. The whole Prajnaparamita is just recited in this one letter. And there's more too. But they go from very, very, very long to very, very short. The Heart Sutra is the most popular, pretty short one. So in the 25,000 line, large sutra, at the very beginning of the sutra, we hear Ananda, who heard all the sutras, say, "Thus have I heard. The Blessed One, the Buddha, dwelt at Rajagriha on Vulture Peak with a whole bunch of monastics and lay people and bodhisattvas and dragons and elephants and so on. And thereupon, the Blessed One, having arranged the lion seat, the Aryasana, sat down, cross-legged, Paryanka," or when they translate the sutra into Chinese, he sat in Keikafuza with his legs tied up in a cross-legged posture with upright body, intent, stable mind. The Buddha entered the Samadhi Raja Samadhi, the king of Samadhi's Samadhi, in which, all Samadhis are included. There's no other Samadhis that are outside this Samadhi. There's no other Samadhis that are related to this Samadhi. There are no Samadhis that are apart from this king of Samadhis, Samadhi. He entered the king of Samadhis, Samadhi, in which all other Samadhis, all other presences, all other types of unified awareness are included. He entered the king of Samadhis, Samadhi, in which all Samadhis are included, comprehended, and come to meet. Thereupon, the Blessed One mindfully emerged from this Samadhi and surveyed the entire world system with his divine eye. And I think that might be the end of the discussion in these 25,000 hundreds of lines about this Samadhi. The name is mentioned, and it's only briefly described as the king of Samadhi, Samadhi being the Samadhi in which all other Samadhis are included and comprehended and come to meet. It's a like the first paragraphs of this giant sutra, and then no more mention of it. Maybe other samadhis are mentioned. So that's the scriptural source here. And then around the year 400, some centuries after this sutra appeared, this treatise appeared that was translated by the great Indian translator Kumar Najiva. And it's attributed to the great Bodhisattva Nagarjuna, but there's a lot of debate in more recent times about who actually wrote this treatise, because the style is very different from Nagarjuna's middle way verses. But this treatise, it's called the Maha Prajna Paramita Upadesha, or Shastra. There's no Indian Sanskrit version left. It was supposedly translated from Sanskrit, but we just have the Chinese. It's epic. It's much longer than the longest Prajnaparamita sutras. Somebody translated it into French. We have it around this world system now. Then somebody translated it from French into English. And there's digital copies floating around. So I was just looking at this, and it's like in small print pages, it's like 2,000 pages. The devotion to just translate this, even from French into English, is inspires and amazes me. And it's like, there's maybe like 300 pages or so before they get to "Thus have I heard." Line by line, maybe not line by line, but it's basically going through this whole large Prajnaparamita Sutra and commenting in great detail, as the tradition does. So even though there's only a sentence about the Samadhi Raja Samadhi in the sutra, in this treatise attributed to Nagarjuna, there's a lot about it, a lot of commentary about this Samadhi. And that's what Dogen is reading here. This treatise, it's called the Dajur Dulun in Chinese, the Dachi Doran in Japanese. These huge, epic volumes of Prajnaparamita commentary about just like, it's kind of like a source book for all of Buddhism, which is why it became very popular in China. And I think people nowadays say it was maybe or probably written in China. And a lot of people think, well, maybe Kumar Ajiva, who translated a lot of sutras from the Sanskrit, maybe he actually just was so inspired by these sutras that he wrote the commentary and attributed it to Nagarjuna. There's lots of speculation on who actually wrote it, but it's become very important in East Asia. There's no Tibetan or Indian, but in China and Japan, it's like a source book for like all the Buddhist teachings, especially Mahayana teachings. And Dogen quotes it quite a bit, actually, in different essays. Dogen, I don't know if you read the whole 2,000 pages, but yeah, he picks up on some pieces. And I think that this section of this treatise seems to be the inspiration for this essay of Dogen. At least the title of the essay comes from the sutra, and particularly this treatise that expands on the sutra. So right at the beginning of this section, a few hundred pages into the treatise, it's like a series of questions and answers. I guess the answers are supposed to be Nagarjuna, and an imaginary questioner. So first question is, the sutra said, the Blessed One having arranged this lion seat, this kind of lion throne to sit on, he sat down on it cross-legged. So this is how detailed the questions get. It's like, okay, so if the Buddha has these attendants like Ananda, why didn't they arrange the lion seat for him? Why did he have to arrange it himself? They're really getting into detail, right? Like, before we talk about the samadhi, why did he arrange the seat himself? This is how you can fill 2,000 pages. And the answer to that question, why he arranged the Sima Asana himself, the lion seat himself? Well, because Buddha's mind created the seat. He arranged it with his mind. The next question is, there are many sitting postures. Why does Buddha just sit cross-legged? Kekafusa. Answer. Cross-legged posture is the most calm and the least tiring posture. Now, if you tell this to a bunch of people who've been sitting cross-legged for 3 days, they might not agree that it's the most comfortable and least tiring posture. But it might be any posture of sitting long enough become uncomfortable. And I think there is something to this. I think this posture was designed in ancient India to be, as we talked about, conducive to the balancing of the subtle body, but also to be a comfortable, stable foundation. It's the most calm and least tiring posture. By holding our hands and feet in this way, the mind does not wander. That's the answer to why this posture. Then the next section, right after this Q&A, the expounder of the treatise, supposedly Nagarjuna, says this on page 2 of our Dogen essay. This is the next section. So Dogen says, Shakyamuni Buddha preached to the great assembly in the Dajjardulun, this treatise. But, you know, technically, if you look at the treatise, it's not actually the Buddha's words, but it's the treatise compiler's words. Quote, if you're sitting cross-legged, body and mind realize samadhi. Here it says, great virtue revealed by all is yours. Clunky translation. Maybe better to say, it's talking about the posture of Zazen. Its virtue and dignity can be recognized by all. You are like the sun illuminating the world. I think that's a nice image for boundless presence. Is awareness is illuminating the world, and it's illuminating itself at the same time. And if we take that into the very time of sitting and investigate, what's the difference between illuminating the world, between awareness illuminating the world and illuminating itself? We might find that there's no difference, because the world that's being illuminated is the awareness itself. So maybe strictly speaking, ultimately speaking, awareness doesn't really illuminate the world. It only illuminates itself, but sometimes it illuminates itself in the form of the world. But the world is not something other than the awareness. But here, conventionally speaking, in this cross-legged samadhi, you're like the sun illuminating the world. Lethargy, sleepiness, laziness, mind numbing, and sloth are dispelled in the upright posture. The body is light, the mind is tireless. Even awakening comes quickly and easily. Or another version of that section is wakefulness and realization are also light and easy. In Chinese, it's kaku go. It's like awakening and satori, is this character, are light and easy, just like the body and the mind. Sitting serenely like a dragon coiled. Maybe the image of a coiled dragon is like, there's this stability, like a snake, a coiled snake. There's a stability in there and a kind of readiness and power with a coiled dragon can spring at any moment, and yet it's resting very calmly in this state of perpetual. When we look at a coiled dragon, maybe there's a little kundalini oblique reference here too. Faced with depictions of cross-legged sitting, or you could translate it as like faced with pictures or drawings or paintings of cross-legged sitting, King Mara staggers with fright. Y'all know King Mara, the Buddha's nemesis, the evil one. Mara literally means like death. This is, I think, interesting. It's the name, the proper name of this, harasser of Buddha that comes to knock Buddha off his seat, right? Especially on the night of Buddha's great awakening, Mara came and attacked, tried to knock the Buddha off his seat. And so we could hear this as the as a real kind of demon that gets like doesn't want anybody to realize the truth, or more psychologically, people might interpret it as it's just like a little bit of delusion that was left in the Buddha's mind stream. He was getting closer and closer to awakening. It was like the last traces of his own self-grasping in the form of Mara. And then what I love about these old suttas is after the Buddha's great awakening, he's a perfect Buddha. Throughout his life, occasionally, not often, but occasionally, Mara still comes to visit and kind of like poke at Buddha. One of the ones I remember is that Buddha's getting old, but he still has some work to do to fully establish the Sangha and awaken some others. And Mara comes and says, you've done so great, Buddha. You've set this all up. You can just peacefully die now. And the Buddha says to Mara, don't mess with me, Mara. Not quite yet. I'll let the body die when it's time. But there's some things to do. This is his own unconscious. There was this an outside force. Is there anything outside of Buddha? So this sentence here, faced with pictures or drawings, paintings or statues of cross-legged sitting, King Mara staggers with fright. Just to see an image of that posture, Mara gets all like freaked because like this posture can overcome Mara. Mara's afraid of this cross-legged upright sitting. he staggers with fright. Must he not recoil in even greater terror when seeing a wayfarer seated calm and unmoved? Like a, not just a statue or a picture, but an actual person sitting in this posture. Then Mara really freaks out. So some points about this, that's the quote from the Prajnaparamita treatise. And I think this earlier section, part sense in this, if you're sitting in this meditation posture, body and mind realize samadhi, and its virtue and dignity can be recognized by all. It makes me think of the story of Kodo Sawaki Roshi, another great Zen masters of this era, when he was a young monk living in a small temple, and he just recently learned how to practice Zazen. And he was in this temple after a sesshin or after some kind of teachings or something, and the other group of young monks went off to kind of went into town at the end of the retreat, and young Kotsuwaki didn't want to go into town, and so everybody left. He said, "Well, what should I do?" Yeah, no, I guess it just said Zazen. And so he did. And there was this temple caretaker, kind of older woman who's would always kind of poke at young Kodo Sawaki and kind of like tell him to clean his room and wash the dishes and take care of his chores and things like this. She, treated him like the kid that he was. So young Kodo has arranged himself in the Zazen posture of upright sitting and just was sitting there. And this cleaning woman caretaker, who usually teased him, came in and saw the sitting form of Kodo Sawaki in the Zendo and immediately started bowing to the form of Zazen. And he says, "This was a real turning point for me as a teenager when I saw this woman who treated me so differently. When I saw her bowing to me, not to me really, bowing to the form of Zazen, I really got a new understanding of the power of this upright sitting. It's inconceivably moves people." As Nagarjuna says here, its virtue and dignity can be recognized by everyone, the posture. And another story that comes to mind about this, just seeing a picture of upright sitting. Mara starts shaking in terror, and it's so moving just to see the mere image of it, not to mention an actual person. My teacher, old Buddha Tenshin, often tells the story of how he got into Zen practice. And it seems like one of the main conditions for him being inspired to start Zen practice is when he was like a teenager, I think, a young man, he saw this photo on the cover of Life magazine of a Zazen practitioner in Japan. It was like an article on Zen in Japan or something in the 60s. It was just a black and white photo of from the back of a person sitting very upright in Zazen. And he said, when I saw that picture, I thought, I want to practice that. Of course, he did. And that photo is, last I saw, is still hanging on the wall of his Dokusan room. The old cover of Life magazine. I think it's not even a priest. It's like a lay practitioner sitting on a tatami mat, very upright. So that's an example. Seeing an image of the Zazen posture was enough to get this wayfarer onto the Zen path and do it for the entire rest of his life for the benefit of everyone. What's with this posture? I think there's just a few little interesting details in here. There's one other interesting detail that when Carl Bielefeld's translating this, is heavily annotated, and really looked into this. So we have Dogen's quote from the Chinese Shastra here. So it's basically word for word. He pulls out just the Chinese of this Prajnaparamita Upadesha. And but Carl went in there and kind of like looked at the original Chinese, and there's one character in this section that Dogen kind of added in there with no comment or anything. So you have to be really kind of pretty geeky to discover these kind of things. I don't think Dogen meant for it to even be discovered, probably, but it's so interesting. It's such a little little Dogen signature kind of hidden in his quoting this. He changed the treatise and didn't say so. And the place is this word wayfarer. Must Mara not recoil in even greater terror when seeing a wayfarer seated calm and unmoved? A wayfarer is, I think, a great English term for Dojin, which appears kind of commonly in Zen and other Buddhist texts in China. Do is way, Dao, Jin is person. So it's a way person, which means a practitioner of the way. It's a nice, sure way to say, to call it practitioner of the way, Dojin, a way person. A wayfarer is that kind of nice in English, right? We're talking about the Buddha way, a Buddha wayfarer. So Dogen left this, this Dojin, but the original, supposedly Nagarjuna, right? The original old treatise says, seeing and entering the way person, new Dojin. A person who's entered the way or entering the way. Dogen changes this one character for enter to his favorite character, show, which means verify, confirm, as in practicing verification or not to. It's just this tiny little detail, but it's so Dogen to do this, right? He's like, let's not talk about how awesome somebody who enters the way is. Let's shift it a little bit and talk about, we're talking about someone verifying the way. He loves this word verify or confirm. And it made you feel like the way is not something that you enter. The way is something that you verify. And that's a geeky detail, but it's so, I just like appreciate, I feel like I get to know Dogen's quirky personality by these little things that this thing does, without even saying that he's doing it. So then Dogen comments on this section. Very straightforward. Just repeats it, basically. He says, even King Mara is amazed, distressed, and filled when he sees drawings or pictorial depictions of cross-legged sitting or the meditation posture. Imagine the terror he feels when he's faced with actual cross-legged sitting itself, the merit of which is impossible to fully calculate. It then follows, wherever there is upright sitting, actually says he, or wholehearted sitting, actually, taza. Wherever there's wholehearted sitting, there's also blessings and virtue beyond measure. It's like blessings and virtue beyond measure, which was not annotated, but maybe referring to this Lotus Sutra verse about eyes of compassion, observing sentient beings, assembling ocean of blessings and virtue beyond measure. Dogen loved the Lotus Sutra, so sometimes we riffs on it a little bit. Why? Why does it follow that wherever there's sitting, there's also blessings and virtue beyond measure? Shakyamuni Buddha's next words to the assembly were thus, and again, technically speaking, it's not Shakyamuni here, but it's supposedly Nagarjuna, whoever wrote this treatise, this commentary on the Buddha's words. It is because of this blessings and virtue that I sit cross-legged, or that I sit in the meditation posture, or that one sits in the posture. Therefore, I, Nagarjuna, or Buddha, or whoever, instruct all the disciples to sit like this, nyoje, to sit thus. Non-Buddhists seek the way by constantly standing on tiptoe, by remaining constantly standing, or by entwining their legs about their necks. The minds of these overzealous practitioners are sunk in a sea of falsehood. And there's all kinds of yogic practice in ancient and modern India of kind of renunciation practices of putting the body in very painful situations in order to kind of overcome the body. And this was happening in 500 BC and still happens amazingly. So just as long as this cross-legged upright sitting posture has lasted, so have all these other weird, painful practices and postures lasted. There's maybe something compelling about them too. Like standing on tiptoe forever just to, you know, let go of attachment to the body, remaining constantly standing, or entwining legs about the neck and these awkward yogi postures. Though it might be very zealous, it's missing the point, I think is what the Buddha is saying, and this treatise is saying. These configurations and postures these people assume are unstable. Hence the Buddha taught his disciples to sit cross-legged with upright mind, actually says. It is because with the body upright, the mind is easily more the mind is easily rectified or made true. In upright sitting, the mind does not grow slothful. With upright mind and right thought, mental activity is concentrated right before you. If the mind wanders, if the body starts to waver, you can put them to rest and collect them. Character for Sesshin, Setsu. Sesshin means to collect the mind. You say you can collect the straying mind, like Sesshin. Once again, if you wish to realize samadhi, if you wish to enter samadhi, put to rest all your wandering thoughts, all the various discords and disorders in your mind. Practice in this way and you will enter and realize the king of samadhi is samadhi. Pretty straightforward. I don't think there's no explanation needed. As far as these yogic postures, painful yogic postures. There's one old sutra that in the middle length discourses called the dog duty ascetic. And it's kind of about this topic. There was, I guess, practice in Buddha's time, and maybe still is, of these people in different yogic schools, so many yogis in ancient India. There was one group called the dog duty ascetics, and their practice, their spiritual practice, was to act like a dog. So as a practice of renunciation, really, I think, and getting over like attachment to the comforts of being human. So they would go naked, they'd walk around on all fours, and they wouldn't eat out of bowls or plates. You have to put the food on the ground and they would eat it with their tongue without picking it up. Like really trying to imitate dogs. And, you know, no joke. I mean, in the sutra, it sounds like there really was this sect. And they thought they were really on, they thought this is really, we're gonna really get over this attachment to human body and human dignity and all these things that we cling to. And they had been going for a while, I guess. And at some point they came to the Buddha. One of them came. I think one of the disciples just learning the dog duty practice and said, our master's been doing this for, you know, decades. And what would be his destination after his body dies? We're hoping it's nirvana, no more birth with such an intense practice. And the Buddha says, don't bother me with that kind of question. And the disciple of the dog says, no, really, I really want to know. I mean, you have a great reputation for having this divine eye and knowing what future rebirths of practitioners will be like due to their karma. So tell us, we're devoted to this teacher. We know you're going to say perfect nirvana. The Buddha says, no, you don't need to know about this. And they keeps pushing him. And the Buddha says, if you keep pushing me, then like, I'll tell you if you really want to know. He's going to be reborn as a dog. The disciple is quite disappointed. I can't remember if he kind of converts to the Buddha way at this point. But it's a nice story too, about just a simple story about maybe, we don't know exactly how all this works, but karmic conditioning is deep, right? So you spend your whole life thinking like a dog and acting like a dog, then you just creating the conditions for further being like a dog. Maybe not so complex. So if you sit in the upright meditation posture a lot, could it be that chances are that if we're born again, we'll gravitate towards that posture in a future life? Could be. Cause and effect is powerful and mysterious. Creating conditions now will result in future results based on the conditions. This is Buddha's like more kind of bottom line basic teachings. Exactly how it works, we don't know. Exactly what causes you to, exactly what effects, we don't know. But we do know that if we're really mean to people, we're probably not going to be that happy. Anyway, stop here for now. And do you have anything to bring up? Jikoji Ino. Now there's two of you. That's amazing. Transformation body work.
I aim to please. All things are reflected in all other things in the universe, in the Indra's eye. So as all samadhis are part of the King Samadhi, are all samadhis then reflective of the King Samadhi as well? And does knowing that help us with our samadhi?
Ah, that's a beautiful question. Yes, it would seem so. And what might be an example of such a thing? If the king of samadhi is boundless presence, all-inclusive, big mind that's not related to anything outside of itself. And, you know, it's not said so explicitly in this essay, but we could understand it that way. Then another type of, if that's the all-inclusive one, the king of samadhi, then a samadhi like a state, like concentrating one pointedly and developing the first jhana, or the second, third, or fourth, would be like, you could say those would be like specific samadhi states that would be included within the king of samadhi, because everything is. And so they're reflected within it, mutually reflective, all one samadhi really, and yet we could distinguish them. And then would this be helpful? It could be quite helpful, because if one was practicing jhana, a very specific meditation state, a temporary meditation state, which jhanas are, within this unchanging king of samadhis, and one kind of was open to that perspective, that might be a wonderful way to practice the specific jhana state of samadhi. It might kind of like have a more expansive sense, that samadhi, or even the context of it. Maybe the samadhi, the jhana, is just defined as the jhanas are defined quite specifically. So it could be that that's just the jhana. But maybe another benefit could be then when one comes out of that jhana, which is how it's taught, that one does enter and exit jhanas. Unlike this king of samadhi, samadhi is not something that one enters and exits. If one exited the specific first jhana samadhi, and when then was open to this perspective, one could feel like, instead of like, I lost that and now I'm back just in my everyday like crummy old mind, and they're like, well, I exited that specific practice, but I'm still in the king of samadhi is samadhi, so there's not really any loss at all. That could be a benefit, great benefit. Yes, Ken.
So could that be something similar? This be something similar? So calm abiding and vipassana are also within boundless awareness itself. So it almost seems like a circular reference in a sense.
Yeah, that's a nice point that we've been talking about, calm abiding and vipassana, like especially inquiry practices are specific practices. We're not always inquiring. We're talking about the practice and calm abiding. We're not always cultivating that. We're not always calm. So yeah, though you could say those are temporary. Even the insight, the result of vipassana being this a fresh insight or confirmation, verification. Even that you could say is a momentary confirmation, even if it's a confirmation of unchanging reality. You could say, it, at least at first, maybe that the confirmation seems to fade. So in that way, yeah, they're temporary. So you could say, both the calm abiding and the vipassana are happening within the king of samadhis, samadhi. And they're, you could even say they're the purpose of the calm abiding and the inquiry practice is to verify the king of samadhis, samadhi that we're already in, but it's to verify it, particularly to verify that it is the samadhi that includes all of your samadhis. There's no samadhis outside of it. Outside of it, you could say we're doing these practices within the space of reality in order to confirm the space of reality. Is that kind of what you went towards? Yeah, excellent point.
Thank you.
And if we have some maybe just trust. Even without, before we verify, even just hearing such teachings and feeling open to them, then maybe the way that we practice calm abiding and inquiry is a little bit different based on this trust, right? It's more like, it's just a bigger picture where we're kind of playing around in this big ocean instead of like, we're not in a big ocean, we're just, we gotta figure things out here. The whole thing is very contracted and squeezed in my narrow world. And I gotta do these practices in this narrow world to get over this. But I've heard that I'm not really a snake, a big snake stuffed into a small can, that there's a big world. And even though I feel like this can stuff snake, but trusting that maybe it's not really like that, then I can do these practices. It's a different perspective with which I'm doing the practices. And maybe what starts as just a kind of faith or trust, eventually by doing the practices becomes confirmed or verified.
So Uchiyama Roshi said, basically take the posture and entrust everything to it. Would that be similar or something like you're saying?
That sounds very resonant with this particular Dogen essay, right? It's emphasizing posture so much. Yeah, kind of like, almost like there's something magic in the posture in this essay and in that kind of statement. So yeah, that's one instruction. That's maybe more of a, if we have to fit it into the calm abiding or insight camp, if we had to put that statement into one or the other, I would maybe put it in the calm abiding side, because it's kind of saying you don't need to figure this out, or you don't need to inquire into this, just trust it. And I think that's maybe an aspect of the calm abiding, is just trust that sitting is good, and we need trust in order to do, especially to sit for like days on end. We need quite a bit of trust, and then as we start to verify the reality of the situation more and more, you could say the verification builds the trust. What maybe started as somewhat blind faith kind of trust, trust because people we respect recommend it, for example, then we're doing it, and then the doing it verifies, oh, this is really actually trustworthy. And then we have even more trust to sit this way. And then by sitting this way, that verifies the reality even more, and we have even more trust. So yeah, I think that's the beauty of practice. Seems if we're on the right track, it keeps evolving and keeps the deepening, and keep the trust gets stronger and stronger. And so if we feel like, actually, I have a lot of doubts about this practice, and the more I do it, the more doubt I have. This sometimes does happen too. And I think in this case, then we should talk to somebody. Or it's change something. It means like something's off track. Doug San.
Yeah, again.
Here on two opposite corners of the screen.
So I don't know which screen to speak to here. Speaking of the boundless, I really appreciated the question about does boundless presence have a perspective? Because from just that question comes, you know, it can be yes, it can be no, but also does bounded presence have a perspective? And yes, this bounded presence has a perspective. And the edges of the boundary is not clear. And at lunchtime, there were four of us that joined together, four bounded presences together in this process of Orioki. And the bounded presence was also aware, each was aware of the other. And so the bounded presence perspectives were also aware of each other. And we were in harmony, mostly. You know, of course, there's people pay attention or don't. But this this question of boundless presence that each of us can tap into is also a way we tap into each other.
Yeah, or you could say that in no way there are two different realities at the same time. One is there's a boundless boundless presence with no point of view. It's really inconceivable, actually. ultimate reality. Almost we barely talk about it, but we're trying. And there's the bounded presence in this way of like, the sense of being a point of view, which is we could call a sentient being a person. And these bounded presences are in relation to each other. Suzuki Roshi is saying, big mind is not related to anything because everything's included within it. That's one truth. And within this oneness, there are these individual points of view, and those are always related and harmonious with each other and interdependent. And these two realities, the one of a group of people in harmony with each other, and the other reality of just one reality where there's no individuals, those two are not really two. Both perspectives are totally valid and both true and not contradictory. That's what's so nice about this, is that it's not like you have to choose one or the other. You can't choose one or the other. It's always both one big mind. I'd even say it's like it's not like there's a bunch of big minds. There's only one big mind. And then there's the individual points of view, expressions of big mind. And those ones are in harmony. And that's the realm where we can actually practice harmonizing with each other instead of fighting with each other. And this is a good point. There's both of these realities are simultaneous. Just like the mirror, there's this one mirror which doesn't really have a point of view. And then all the people that are reflected in the mirror are in harmony and interacting with each other as the images. And their true nature, all the people doing Orioki together on the surface of the mirror, the true nature of each of these people is identical. In other words, it's the mirror, and it's not like, well, my true nature is this mirror and your true nature is that mirror. No, we're on the same mirror. It's not even like very similar true natures. There's nothing to distinguish our true natures. So both are true. Yeah, and this issue of this boundless awareness have a point of view. I think that's right, that it can't really have a point of view, because as soon as there's a point, then that's just one location. One could even say, if it's truly one boundless awareness, it's impossible for there to be any experience if it's just the reality of one boundless awareness with no point of view. There's no such thing as experience. Like, for example, seeing, you could say, if we want to, we're looking at, there's a tree there. How would boundless awareness that's not restricted to any particular person, how would that boundless awareness see the tree? It would have to be like, there would have to be like an eye at every location in the entire universe. Something like this, right? Throughout all the space would have to be filled with eyes, because if you locate an eye in one place, then it's a point of view again. So if boundless space, like it's not, really the ultimate one, it's not limited to any person, if that space-like awareness were to have an experience of seeing a tree, it would have to be eyes, infinite eyes everywhere. Every point of space would equally have to have an eye, and then they'd all be looking at this tree, right, from a different from infinite angles, they'd be looking at this tree. And what would that look like to these infinite eyes with no particular point of view? It would not look like a tree. It wouldn't look like anything at all, because it would be like every possible, if you combine every possible point of view, infinite points of view, to look at one object, it wouldn't be an experience at all. It wouldn't be anything. So in order to experience a world, like, or a tree, we need to have a point of view. We need to have located eyes and ears and stuff to experience trees and sounds. Which is quite nice to have a world and a body and so on. Seems like that will always be the case, it seems. So we have this point of view, and we can also open to this inconceivable, pointless view. It's pointless because there's no points of view, but it's also kind of pointless to even talk about it. But by acknowledging this ultimate inconceivable reality, true boundlessness, then I think it informs our bounded, located reflection of personhood. You're good.
I believe I've been hearing Sandokai here.
Emerging
of difference.
Emerging of difference in unity.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And both are true. The world of differences is in total harmony with the world of unity. And I would say the way we harmonize, like that beautiful description of this Orioki meal of each person has their own point of view, and yet the points of view are harmonized. That's the world of difference. And we need to study and practice in the world of difference in order to be able to harmonize. And that's, we're pretty familiar with it, even though we're not always in harmony. We're familiar with difference, but the realm of unity, like really exploring and investigating the realm of unity, is outside of a group of Zen people. Maybe most people don't spend so much time even wondering about that realm because it's so inconceivable. But that's maybe one of the unique qualities of Buddha Dharma and Zen practices. We're interested in this realm of unity, which again, I think sometimes people would say, isn't the harmony amongst all beings, isn't that the unity? The way we're talking today, I would say not exactly. I think that's that realm of interdependence is the realm of difference. Harmony amongst people is difference that's functioning very nicely, harmoniously. And the unity is the realm where there's no relationship. This is, I think, somewhat unusual. We usually think, well, isn't our interrelationship and interdependence, isn't that the ultimate truth? My understanding is that that's a really beautiful conventional truth. And the ultimate truth, as Suzuki Roshi put it quite nicely, you know, big mind is not related to anything. There's no, it's true unity that is not relationship. Both are true, right? But I would say the relationship, interdependence is strictly speaking, conventional truth. It's a truth, conventional reality. It's a reality. And then the ultimate reality is there's no relationship. And you could say, well, what about like total delusion? Like we're not related. We're each independent, separate beings, truly separate. That I would say is not either of the two truths. That's not a conventional truth. That's pure delusion. This is maybe a slightly different way of talking about the two truths than we sometimes hear. The two truths are satya, they're realities. And being separate is not actually a reality.
One other, I appreciate the example of a tree, because you know, a tree being a construct, or a concept, and you know, how much of existence shares that concept? You know, it just falls away beyond.
It's a concept. So, I mean, even animals don't see a tree as a tree because they don't have this word. But even going even further than it's just a concept, even the direct sense perception of the image of the tree, a non-conceptual image of a tree, even that needs a point of view, like needs an eyeball in a certain location. Yeah, which is I think one of the really radical teachings of Mahayana Buddhadharma. As you go further and further, you see like Indian Yogacara philosophy and all, it just goes really, really deep. So it's, of course, our concepts are distorted, but this tradition is saying our direct sense perceptions of just pure seeing color, pure sound before there's any conceptuality. This Yogacara tradition says, that's all diluted too. It's not really like that. So it's just like the deeper down the rabbit hole we go, the more it's like, I mean, not just my thoughts, but my sense perceptions are completely distorted before there's any concept. And they're saying, yeah, there's still like a kind of duality going on there. There's still before the concepts, there's still some sense of the color being separate from the mind in direct sensory perception. And that's an illusion, according to that tradition. So, because of this, the meditation posture is so inspiring and so frightening to Mara. And Mara's like, there's lots of Maras like circling around us right now that are like, coming closer and closer, and like they're like, if this guy keeps spouting all this conceptual gibberish, we're gonna like fully attack. So I think we quick get back to Zazen and assume the upright posture of Zazen, and Mara will immediately flee.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.